Good evening and welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Arthur Crowther, a member of the International Relations Forum and your chair for today. We welcome our listeners on the radio. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Dr. Peter Bossard is the Policy Director of International Rivers, a nonprofit organization based in Berkeley, California. Dr. Bossard leads International Rivers' efforts to strengthen social and environmental standards used by government, financial institutions, and industrial organizations around the world. He has special expertise in hydroelectric projects, and he obtained his PhD from the University of Zurich. Dr. Bossard will speak today on China's new global role and the environment, focusing especially on China's projects in Africa. Please give a warm welcome to Dr. Peter Bossard.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here tonight. I would like to thank the Commonwealth Club for the opportunity to speak here this evening. You can't quite see it behind the pulpit, but today I'm wearing 9 pieces of clothing. I counted this morning, and of these 9 pieces, 4 were made in China. And my guess is the numbers would look similar for most of you. China's economy plays a huge role in our daily lives, and this role obviously comes with environmental impacts. I will talk about these environmental impacts on the planet today, and because the topic is quite large, I will primarily focus on the impacts in Africa. The topic, China's environmental footprint on the planet, has become a very hot topic in the news. We know, for example, from World Bank studies about the environmental destruction within China. The World Bank estimates that water and air pollution cause about 750,000 premature deaths in China every year. 16 of the 20 most polluted cities are located in China. But environmental impacts are also felt around the globe. Chinese companies are involved in illegal logging operations in many countries: Burma, Indonesia, Russia, West Africa. China has also become the world's leading dam builder outside its borders. Right now, we are aware of 79 large dams which China is building, and we're still counting. Last year, China also became the world's largest emitter of CO2. I'd like to start the presentation with a case study of a Chinese dam in Sudan, then present China's global economic expansion, and particularly in Africa, a bit more generally. I'll then go into the environmental concerns regarding this expansion. I'll talk about how China has responded to these concerns and what the background, what China's long-term interests are, and I'll end with some concluding remarks. Let me also say a few words about my organization, International Rivers. We are an international environmental and human rights group based in Berkeley. Our mission is to protect rivers and the communities which depend on them. We're using different strategies to pursue this mission. We work to stop some of the most destructive projects. We try to strengthen environmental policies of dam builders, financial institutions, governments, and we promote better alternatives. China's impacts on the world's rivers has become a huge challenge for us. And so we started a program to strengthen China's environmental standards in 2006. We are a membership organization. We're accepting new members right now, and you'll find some of our publications at the back of the room. In the interest of full public disclosure, I would also like to say a few things about my own background. I have been based in the United States, in the Bay Area, for 6 years now, working for International River, so I have the perspective of an environmental activist and professional. My partner, my girlfriend, is from China, so I also have a good understanding for the Chinese perspective, and I have a lot of sympathy for the right of a poor country to develop its economy. I'm a native of Switzerland. The Swiss are famously neutral, for better or worse. And so I also try to balance these perspectives, the environmental limits of the planet and the right of poor countries to develop. I'll try to do this in this presentation and more generally in my work. Okay, let's get into our topic. Let's start with a case study, the Merowe Dam in Sudan. The Merowe Dam is a large dam on the Nile in northern Sudan. It will roughly double Sudan's electricity generation with a capacity of 1,250 megawatts. The reservoir will displace up to 70,000 people from the fertile Nile Valley into arid desert locations. Here you see the villages in which the affected people lived before displacement and the resettlement colony in the desert. I had the chance to visit the site, the resettlement colony, in 2005, and we could just tell that poverty in these camps was rapidly increasing. There have been numerous protests by the affected people against their plight, against the project, and there has been serious human rights violations, including shootings and killings. The project, which is on the main stem of the Nile, upstream from the Aswan Dam, has massive environmental impacts. The dam is currently being built, but there has never been an independent environmental impact assessment. UNEP, the UN Environmental Program, estimated in 2006 that the project will have serious negative impacts on aquatic life, on water quality, on agriculture, and through the spreading of malaria, also on public health. And EAWAG, the Federal Hydrological Research Institute of Switzerland, of the Swiss government, found in 2006 in an in-depth study that the project was far from meeting European or international standards. The Sudanese government undertook strong efforts to build and finance the dam in the 1990s, traveled around the world to try and raise funding. But because there is no environmental impact assessment, they failed to attract funds from Canada, from a series of European countries, and from the World Bank. We know specifically that COFAS, the export credit agency of the French government, refused to finance the project and French contracts in it for environmental reasons. Here you see the headquarters of the World Bank and COFAS. That was in the 1990s. The project did not go ahead. The affected people were happy and the International Rivers was happy. Everything changed in 2002 when China stepped forward to fill the gap. The Chinese government approved loans from China Exim Bank, and we'll talk about them shortly, to the tune of $520 million. And so the project could start. It attracted additional funding from Arab financial institutions. And the dam is currently being built by companies from China, Sudan, Germany, and friends. The Chinese government has always defended the Marowei Dam. We brought an activist from the affected area to Beijing in May of last year to raise the concerns about this project, and the spokesperson of the foreign ministry here defended the project and Chinese involvement in it and said, regarding Marowei, that China takes the possible environmental effect seriously and applies strict environmental standards. I had the chance to discuss the project with the president of China Exim Bank at the end of 2006. He said that he was aware that there were problems in the project and that he would send a team to investigate, but we don't know whether this has actually happened. The dam will soon be completed, but the problems have never been addressed. There are now plans for a new dam to be built on the Nile between the Marowei Dam and the Aswan Dam in the Nubian part of Sudan, called the Kashbar Dam. From the beginning, people are protesting. There has been serious repression, and several people have been killed by security forces already. China, at the beginning, expressed an interest in the project, but so far has not become involved. And we're, of course, through our partners in Sudan, are watching the situation, and we're very interested to see whether the Chinese government, the Chinese dam builders, have in fact learned lessons from the Marowei experience. Here you see a protest against the Kashbar Dam in Nubia, in the Nubian part of Sudan. The Marowei Dam is an example for a larger trend. So let's now talk about China's going out strategy more general. China has for a long time been a closed economy, but in the 1980s and 90s, China invited inward foreign investment very actively, and around the turn of the century also decided to go abroad with a very aggressive going out strategy. In 2001, China joined the World Trade Organization, opened its economy even more, and took measures to create between 30 and 50 global champion companies, companies which could compete globally in every sector. The government has extended loans, diplomatic support, and other incentives for a rapid expansion of trade and investment. What are the motives of this strategy? We have to be aware that in the last few years, hundreds of millions of people have moved from the countryside to the cities in China looking for work. And the Chinese government is desperate to find markets, including export markets, to create jobs to stave off this looming unemployment crisis. So that's one important motive of going abroad. China has, of course, a large population, and China has also become the world's factory. At the same time, China has very limited natural resources, and so it needs access to resources overseas to keep up this economic model. And China is pursuing a twin strategy to secure access to resources. It's directly investing in oil, in mines, in forests, etc., and also in infrastructure in order to get these resources out of the countries. Sudan is one example. The main interest is in oil exploration, and China has also built a pipeline, a railroad, the Marowei Dam, and other infrastructure to facilitate the extraction of resources. China Exim Bank is an important actor, facilitator in this strategy. The bank was created by the Chinese government in 1994, only 1994. The US and most other industrialized countries have had Exim Banks since the 1930s. The focus of this bank is to support big companies and big projects in their export drive, particularly in the infrastructure sector. Last year, China Exim Bank extended or approved loans for $36 billion. So already, this relatively young institution has become the world's largest export credit agency. They're quite a bit bigger than the World Bank also, and they have become the world's biggest dam funder. China has rapidly strengthened its ties with Africa as part of this growing out strategy. China has had close relations with Africa since the 1960s. Africa is very rich in resources, and so it's been a favorite target or partner of this new strategy. And trade has increased tenfold between 1999 and 2006. Africa has become a major aid destination, and this economic expansion has also been supported by a diplomatic effort. The Chinese president and prime ministers have visited Africa, have visited 18 African countries in 2006 and 2007. In comparison, President Bush, in his first 7 years in office, has visited 5 African countries. He'll leave for another African trip on Friday, and my guess is that China's presence in Africa probably is one of the motives for President Bush's second trips. We'll hear a lot about the problems of this strategy, but I would like to say that China's expansion and role in Africa has also positive impacts. For the first time in many decades, Africa is experiencing a sustained period of economic growth, and economists have calculated that 2% of this growth is due to China's demand for raw materials and also India's, which is quite a bit smaller. In the area of economic policies, African governments have for decades been dependent on the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, the IMF. And these institutions have pretty much dictated economic policies to African governments, which were often shaped by the interests of the North. China's presence has broken the African dependency on Northern donors, and African governments now are more independent in choosing their own development strategies. China is a poor country, and as a poor country, it can offer goods, services, advice to African societies which are maybe more appropriate than what Western governments and corporations can offer. I would like to give 2 examples. China and Africa both have a dual health system. They have a modern health system, but they also have a traditional health system. And China is, for example, exporting a lot of cheap, herbal-based, but very effective anti-malaria drugs, something that Western companies didn't really bother with. China has also become the global leader in renewable energy, for example, in wind and solar energy, and that's very important technologies for lighting rural Africa. However, the focus is not on appropriate technologies. The focus of China's Africa strategy is on mineral extraction. As a reminder, in China, 1/5 of the world population live on 7% of the world's arable land. China has become the world's factory. And so the whole going out strategy is focused on access to minerals. Africa is rich in minerals. And just as importantly, Africa is rich in minerals which so far haven't been accessed by other countries and other companies. There are environmental concerns with this strategy, with this focus, and I would like to present 5 of these concerns. The first is that China's investment in Africa is primarily in sectors which are environmentally sensitive. Oil and gas, obviously in Angola, Sudan, Gabon, other countries. Mining in Zambia, in Congo. Timber in many West African countries. or hydropower dams. We're counting at least 14 Chinese large dams in Africa. A second concern is that China is investing in fragile regions. Most of the attractive oil fields and mineral deposits are already controlled by other companies and governments. And so China's strategy is to access resources which have so far been inaccessible. Inaccessible because they're not very big, not very interesting for other companies. Often inaccessible because of political risk in countries like Congo or Sudan. Or inaccessible because of environmental protection, because they were designated as national parks or otherwise protected area. One example is the Kafue Flats, which you see on this picture, an internationally important wetland in Zambia. China is now building a dam on the Kafue River to power the mining industry in Zambia and will put two national parks in these wetlands at risk. This is an environmental concern. I still want to be explicit that there is also a certain economic sense to this strategy, because China is actually bringing more oil, more minerals to the world market through making these new areas accessible. If China didn't do that and would simply bought resources, oil and others on the world market, the prices would be much higher for oil, gas and other resources than they are now. So I think we benefit from this strategy economically, but there is a high environmental price. China is investing in sensitive sectors and sensitive regions, but still Chinese companies lack appropriate environmental standards. They also lack standards on transparency and public participation in their projects. I would like to mention the example of Sinohydro, which is the largest Chinese dam building company. Sinohydro is involved in at least 30 large dams overseas, but it doesn't have any environmental guidelines. Another example is the Bui Dam in Ghana, where Sinohydro is now building a dam which will flood parts of a national park, which is an important hippo sanctuary. You see some of the Bui hippos here on this picture. And so I've now mentioned Merowe, Kafue Flats in Zambia, Bui in Ghana. In all these examples, the governments first tried to get funding from the World Bank or other Western funders, failed, and then China stepped in. So this is obviously a big change in these sectors. The fourth concern, which is somewhat separate, is the export of dirty industries, including to Africa. Polluting industries tend to move to countries which have low environmental standards. That's an important reason why Western companies moved to China in the 1980s and 90s. That's a reason why Chinese logging companies moved abroad when Chinese government tightened its forest protection laws. And the concern is that now Chinese companies or Western companies based in China may move on to Africa, where environmental standards are even weaker. That's not just an academic concern. We are aware that there are talks between South Africa and China right now about moving polluting companies from or factories from China to South Africa. We've got this statement here from South Africa's vice president that China needs to send some of its polluting industries elsewhere because it is choking on them. We have the capacity to manage these emissions. A fifth concern, finally, are the global ecological limits. There are concerns about the massive consumption of scarce resources, oil, coal, iron, etc. And the question is, will China eat our resources. There are also concerns about impacts on climate change. As I mentioned before, China has become the largest emitter of CO2 emissions. I'd like to add right here that China has become the smokestack for the whole world, because for most products, China's own per capita consumption is still low. And a lot of the pollution that China causes is for products which are then exported to the world markets. So 70% of the timber which China imports from Southeast Asia, for example, the biggest area of origin of Chinese timber imports, 70% are then re-exported. So our bookshelves, or maybe this pulpit here, they may actually be from illegally logged timber in West Africa or in Indonesia. And 30% of China's CO2 emissions, more than 30%, have been calculated to be caused by export products, by the T-shirts and socks, which I mentioned at the beginning. So in a sense, China is also doing the dirty work for us. How has China responded to these environmental concerns about its overseas operations? I mentioned how in the projects in Merauke, Kafue Flats, and Bui, China picked up projects which had first been rejected by Western financiers. And so there is a big concern among Western companies and financiers that they are now losing business to China. And Philipp Maystadt, the president of the European Investment Bank, a big international development institution, said in the end of 2006, "The competition of the Chinese banks is clear. They don't bother about social or human rights conditions." And he claimed that the Chinese had snatched many projects, ready projects, from under the nose of the EIB, his institution. And in response to this development, to this threat, other financial institutions are now lowering their own environmental standards. And so there is a risk of a race to the bottom in terms of environmental standards. How has China responded to these concerns? The traditional Chinese position is expressed, for example, in the Africa policy, which the Chinese government issued in 2006, where it announced that it will increase its assistance to Africa with, quote, no strings attached. And China's deputy foreign minister said famously in 2004, in regards to the Darfur crisis, that, quote, business is business. We try to separate politics from business. China has also rejected Western criticism, more specifically, of insufficient environmental standards. And the Ministry of Foreign Affairs said also in 2006, China does not accept any country imposing its values, social systems, and ideology upon China. Neither will China allow itself to do so to others. And you see a picture from the Bakun Dam, the construction site, a major Chinese dam in the rainforest in Sarawak, Malaysia. Behind this harsh rhetoric, the foreign policy of China is actually changing, and environmental standards regarding overseas investments are evolving. Environmental standards, but also standards on labor rights, on safety, on relations with host communities. There are new guidelines from the government, of financial institutions, and also of private Chinese companies. And when we look at China's foreign policy more generally, this policy has moved from strict non-interference to conditional intervention. China, the Chinese government, for example, put pressure on Sudan last year to accept UN peacekeepers in Darfur. And outside Africa, China imposed sanctions on North Korea after the country's nuclear tests in 2006, something that would have been unthinkable 2 years earlier. And in Africa today, there are more peacekeepers from China than from any other permanent member of the UN Security Council. So China has really strengthened its efforts to maintain peace in Africa. More strictly when we look, or more specifically, when we look at environmental guidelines, there has been a series of new guidelines coming out of the Ministry of Commerce or from the State Council, which is the highest government body in China. I'd like to quickly quote from a new guideline on overseas investment from 2006, which says that companies should, quote, comply with local laws and regulations, pay attention to environmental protection, support local community and people's livelihood. China, the government still owns most of the important big companies, the 150 biggest companies, particularly in sectors like power generation, oil, and mining. And so it has issued instructions on corporate social responsibility to these companies in January of this year. And it instructed them to, quote, set an example of honesty and trustworthiness, resource conservation, and environmental protection. And finally, the environmental policy of China Exim Bank, which says that projects that are harmful to the environment or do not gain approval from environmental administration will not be funded. So far, so good. The policy lacks any specific details, however. Because companies, Chinese companies, are becoming more and more internationally involved, not just through their clients, but also through shareholders, through companies that they try to buy up, through banks, international banks that they want to do business with, they're more and more concerned about their reputation. And so, because of this, there has been a big surge in corporate social responsibility efforts in textile companies, computer, steel, and oil companies with guidelines about workers' rights, safety, environmental policies, etc. Even China's national petroleum company got certified under ISO 14001, which is the leading international environmental standards for private businesses. Most of these efforts have so far been confined to domestic activities, however. One big problem is that these guidelines that have recently been issued are not mandatory, are not binding on companies. But in recent months, some teeth have been added, some sanctions against polluting companies. SEPA, the Chinese equivalent of EPA, in October threatened that polluting companies would be banned from exporting for 1 to 3 years. And 1 month later, they cut loans which banks wanted to give to 12 companies because of their pollution record under what they call their green credit policy. In January 2008, SEPA also adopted the Equator Principles, which are basically the environmental policies of the World Bank, the most important global environmental standard. And so in the future, if Chinese banks don't want to risk having loans cut or export permits withdrawn, they have to consider the environmental policies of the World Bank. What's behind this recent change these evolving environmental standards? For one thing, like any other country, the US or Switzerland, China basically exports its domestic developmental model. And at home and abroad, initially, the focus of this model has been exclusively on economic growth at all cost. The Three Gorges Dam is an example for this model, actually an example which the Chinese government advertised very actively. Many African governments, delegations from South Africa, from Congo, from other countries were invited to visit the Three Gorges project as a model for Africa's development. More recently, China has recognized the price of pollution for its economic model. 750,000 premature deaths because of pollution every year. And leading government officials have said that the Three Gorges Dam has become a potential environmental catastrophe, so not really a model for the world or for Africa anymore. So China is now strengthening its environmental standards at home, and with some time lag, the same is or will be happening in its overseas operation. This also makes economic sense. It's not just a, or maybe not primarily, a change of values. It makes economic sense. If we think about tennis shoes, for example, Adidas, all the other big brands, they produce, manufacture in China, among other countries, and fetch a good price for their shoes because they have a good brand. If the Chinese companies which actually make these shoes would try to export them themselves, they would get maybe 20% of the price because of their brand reputation, which is tinkered with abuse of workers, environmental destruction, human rights abuses, etc. And Zheng Ziwei, one of the most important members of parliament in China, has said, even in developing countries, foreign companies that turn a blind eye to their social responsibilities will be kicked out of the market. And so as part of the current five-year plan, the Chinese government is trying to improve the environmental performance of Chinese companies and move them up the economic value chain. The reputation is not just a problem for Chinese companies, but also the Chinese government more generally. The Chinese government is spending billions of dollars on the Beijing Olympics as part also of an image campaign, obviously, and yet its reputation is at stake through its foreign environmental footprint. And one important reason for China's slowly evolving position on Sudan and Darfur has certainly been Mia Farrow's campaign, Save Darfur campaign, which branded the Beijing Olympics as Genocide Olympics. I would like to point out that it wasn't just northern pressure groups which targeted China's reputation, but that it was also African governments which expected Chinese to act and to help stop the genocide on African soil. Beyond the reputation, beyond the image, long-term investors also have a hard-nosed interest in stability and peaceful relations. In recent years, there have been tensions around Chinese projects and attacks on Chinese projects in Ethiopia, Kenya, Nigeria, Zambia, and other countries. And China realized that it is not so easy to separate business and politics, as the deputy foreign minister said in 2004. Long-term investors have an interest in long-term stability, which includes the protection of the environment and friendly community relations. And when the government issued its new guidelines on overseas operations, environmental standards, etc., it said that company had to follow them in the national interest. Where are we now? We can certainly say that the Chinese government has made progress with domestic environmental rules and has more recently added some T's to actually enforce their implementation. There is still weak standards for overseas awareness, weak for Overseas Investments Week awareness that this is a problem, but the political will and the awareness around these issues is growing in China. Guidelines are evolving, but their implementation is often still lacking. I mentioned that China National Petroleum Corporation is now certified under the international ISO 14001 standard, but the same company is doing most of the oil exploration in Sudan, where not just human rights, but also the environmental track record is horrendous. And so in places like Sudan, these companies certainly aren't implementing these guidelines yet. And there is also a big problem with small companies. Small Chinese companies, like small American or Swiss companies, don't really have to bother about the national interest. They are much more interested in a quick profit. And so there is a big gap also there. So first steps have been taken, but there is still a long way to go. How can we help and speed up this progress? Our own work on China's global role focuses on several strategies. We think information about these issues from the ground is needed. We're doing research. We monitor actual projects. We share information with Chinese NGOs, Chinese media, academics, etc. We're trying to work to strengthen Chinese standards. We're trying to engage in a dialogue with Chinese decision makers. As I mentioned, I was invited to meet with China Exim Bank in 2006, and we're having contacts with, or trying to establish contacts with other institutions. We're also trying to strengthen the capacity of groups and communities which are directly affected by Chinese projects in Africa, in Southeast Asia, in Latin America, etc., so that they know how they can lobby Chinese embassies or Chinese companies. This is a team effort. Our members support this effort, and you're very welcome to join it. In this work, we need to be careful to avoid hypocrisy. In 2006, Secretary of State Rice welcomed the President of Equatorial Guinea in Africa to Washington, D.C., as a good friend of the United States. The government of Equatorial Guinea is very corrupt, known for its human rights abuses, but it's an oil producer and thus a good friend, we guess. There are many double standards like this regarding the environmental impacts, the human rights and corruption implications of our own companies and governments. I'd like to quote one comment from a newspaper in Zimbabwe, which said that the talk that the US and Europe are involved in Africa for democracy, good governance, and human rights is a frightening heap of nonsense. And we can say, okay, that's Zimbabwe, but this comment was widely circulated in China and in Africa, and it certainly reflects a widespread sentiment about the role of the North, of the West in China and in Africa. And so I'd say we need to stand up for the people affected by Chinese dams and oil exploration and logging operations, for international standards in these operations. But in order to do this effectively, we also need to regain our own environmental credibility. I think we have to be aware that Western companies are also flouting environmental standards in China, in Africa, in other parts of the world, and that the biggest threat for the planet's ecosystem is not the overconsumption in China, but in our own countries. So I think we have to stand up for what we believe in, but in trying to forge partnerships and without arrogance. With this, I will end. I thank you very much. I say Guan Yan Hao to our Chinese friends, and happy Valentine's Day to all of you. Thank you very much.
We would like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California. You have been listening to China's New Global Role in the Environment with Dr. Peter Bussard. I'd like to thank Peter for his presentation, and we can now take questions. So,
when you deal with Chinese officials, international rivers, do you do this in their own language?
We have one staff member working on this program which speaks Chinese. One out of two. I don't. I'll have a sabbatical coming up this summer, and I'll use it to learn Chinese. But so far, I'll do it in English.
Two quick questions. One, it seems to me what's happening, I'm really glad you ended on the note of our own kind of double standard, because it seems that really what's happening now is kind of a proxy economic war in Africa, whereas it was the communist war a few decades back between Russia and the U.S., and now it's basically who's going to get to the resources first. And so it seems to me that it's the couple points you made about the positive impacts that China was making in Africa felt a bit of a stretch, just because it seems to me that, in fact, they're not really looking out for Africa or African government or people. It's to make their own profits. And they're not hiring African workers, and they're not building industry there. They're just taking out the resources from Africa. So that's one point I just wanted to have you touch upon. The second is, I'm just curious about your guys' work with Chinese NGOs and their criticism about environmental standards in China.
Mm-hmm. On your first point, I mean, definitely Chinese companies are in Africa to make a profit. That's the same for every company. That doesn't necessarily rule out common interests. You know, there can be win-win situations. Companies can make a profit and do something useful at the same time. So I don't think that's a fundamental inconsistency. You know, China is in Africa for good. China will remain in Africa. And I think China actually has a lot to offer that we can't offer. And China is also building a lot of hospitals, a lot of roads, a lot of other infrastructure which our companies just have never bothered about. And yes, Western governments, under public pressure, and maybe partly because they believed in these values, have in recent years or decades become concerned about corruption, environmental impacts, human rights, etc. But there is also a lot of very hard-nosed, short-sighted politics of interests by our governments and embassies and companies in these countries. And I think you really meet a lot of cynicism in Africa about the role of the West in now suddenly praising the value of good governance and environmental protection, etc. I think the situation is less black and white than we would like to see it. Your question on Chinese NGOs. Chinese NGOs have grown rapidly in the last 5 years or so, including environmental NGOs, with some ups and downs in terms of freedom of speech, etc. But NGOs, environmental NGOs in China are, of course, absolutely overwhelmed by the environmental problems in their own countries. They've grown, but they're still so weak, and the problems are so humongous. So often they say, we realize our overseas operations are very important, but we can't take it on. We just have too much on our plate. And so many have told us, please, you go ahead, you inform us, you support your African partners, etc. We can't do it. There have now been three or four Chinese groups which have come forward and which have started discussion with government officials and through academics, institutes, etc., on these issues, and in some cases have made quite a good progress. For example, one NGO has prepared guidelines on forestry operations, on overseas forestry operations, which the Ministry of Commerce and the Forestry Administration have signed on to. So there is a growing interest, but for most environmental issues, environmental NGOs, the domestic issues are just too overwhelming.
Yeah, the two questions actually. You mentioned that you're working with the NGO there. How receptive is the government of China for, let's say, participation of outsiders to steer up the NGO's activities there? Is there any process in which you have to go through the government to get some legitimacy for doing that? And second, shall I wait for your answer?
Maybe
but
I can answer.
The second is, it's quite an experience for me to listen to you here. It was 1978 at the Stanford University when John Gurley, the professor of economics, returned from China and came back all boosted up saying China is the future. They're going a small scale and they're being so successful in the small is beautiful. And what made that transition after that 1978. Why did they go from such a small scale? They were pioneer in advocating a small scale. Now they went into the larger scale. What happened?
On your second question, there's probably people in the audience who are from China who are in a better situation to answer that. My guess is partly they'll try to learn from the West. For example, when it comes to the auto industry or things like that, you know. But I'm sure there's people who are more legitimate to talk about this very fundamental question. We feel we have to engage with the Chinese government. We can't really put pressure on them effectively. Mia Farrow has been quite effective, but we think that when we tried, we weren't really effective with that, and so we are trying to engage the Chinese government. There is a new generation of managers and bureaucrats, decision makers, who often have studied in the West, at least for some time, who've worked in international organizations or research institutes or so, and who are not aware of NGOs, who know that NGOs are not going to subvert the Chinese state and who are interested in what we have to say. Obviously, it means we won't question the legitimacy of the Chinese government. We won't get into politics. We're not political institutions. And we've realized that we found open ears when we talked, for example, about environmental standards, about the need, the value, experiences in other by other companies, other countries, and why this was important and what China should be doing. It's become very tricky when we criticized or attacked specific projects like the Merowe Dam, because that implicates China's relations with other governments, foreign policy, and foreign policy is not something that can be publicly discussed in China, really. And so we've had sometimes very friendly relations, but then also very aggressive responses when we probably overstepped the line in the view of our Chinese counterparts.
I would trade Chinese foreign policy for U.S. foreign policy any day. I think to balance the impression and image that Americans have of China's footprint, that we should know a little bit more about the U.S. footprint in Africa. And most Americans don't understand U.S. foreign policy. The Ethiopian government, I think, has at least two, if not three, rendition sites on Ethiopian soil, and their military is involved in Somalia and destabilizing the Horn of Africa. So probably most American high school students cannot find the Strait of Hormuz, or adults for that matter, on the map every time they go to the gas station to put gas in our cars. Kenya, the People's Daily, Chinese government newspaper, made a statement that Western-imposed or U.S.-style democracy exacerbates the kind of conflict and death that's happening in Kenya now. Chad, if people don't know, is considered a Western-backed government, and the destabilization of refugees from Sudan to Chad now. People should know the oil knows no boundaries, lies under Sudan and Chad. And then last but not least, we have two U.S. nuclear aircraft carriers that travel from Virginia to Equatorial Guinea. So I just suggest Americans try to study our own history more, as well as colonial history, to understand the plight that the whole third world was in, post-colonialism, and that China has a right, as do most of the third world countries. There was a non-aligned movement that a lot of people don't seem to remember that tried to avoid the kind of Cold War conflicts that so much of the world is still caught up in.
I'm maybe I only want to say something very general on this issue. You know, we're trying not to excuse the Chinese practices with what other countries are doing, and we're trying not to excuse what other countries are doing with what China is doing now, because if we got involved in such a game, it would just result in another race to the bottom. So all these governments have basically signed up to international standards, and parts of their governments and obviously society believes in these values and these standards. And so that's what we try to promote wherever we find these standards at risk. But I mean, very good points, I think.
Hi, I work on extractive industry issues, in particular mining. And I'm curious to know your opinion on the points of leverage, the priority points of leverage, when you're looking at, in particular in the mining sector, how quickly the Chinese are investing in many major mining areas. And what's really frightening to me is that NGOs all around the world do not have the resources, when compared to the industry, to effectively address the issues. So I'm curious, over the next 5 to 10 years, your recommendation as to where NGOs place their resources. Is it with consumers in the U.S. who purchase the products? Is it with the Chinese government or NGOs in China? Is it with export-import banks? You mentioned a lot of people you're working with now. Where would you prioritize that for organizations that have few resources? Thank you.
I mean, you can tell from our own work that we believe we have to work through China. We have to try and encourage the awareness, the debate about these issues within China. We started out working on China Exim Bank's role in financing dams like the Merowe Dam by trying to put pressure on them. A few years ago, they went to Western banks to place bonds to finance their own loans. But it was a very small part of their lending, of their borrowing operations. And so we went to Citibank and to many other banks and told them, look at the track record of China Exim Bank. You shouldn't give them any money. You shouldn't place bonds for them. But, you know, China Exim Bank, Chinese investors don't really need Western capital. They've got all the capital they need within their own borders. And so, and nowadays, China Exim Bank stopped taking up any capital from the international capital markets because they're flush with awash with dollars. And so just trying to put pressure on them like this won't work. However, I really believe that it's in the self-interest of Chinese investors and the Chinese government to take social, environmental, human rights impacts into account. In Zambia, Chinese companies are very active in mining for copper and cobalt. It's quite a famous example, but I'll still relate it here. There have been strikes and violent protests of workers and trade unions, etc., against Chinese mining companies because of their safety and labor rights problems. There were several people killed, and it's become a huge issue in this region. And when the Chinese President Hu Jintao last visited Zambia in exactly 1 year ago, he meant to visit the area, but he couldn't. It became too dangerous. The tensions were running too high over the Chinese presence. That's obviously not a good situation for a long-term investor. And the Chinese companies are now investing in Congo big time, big time. They just closed a $5 billion deal, which will mainly be focused on mining in Congo.
And we have time for just one more question now. So
I think in Congo too, they just have to become more aware of the problems of corruption and human rights impacts, or they will not be there over the long term.
You mentioned that one aspect of your organization's mission is to provide viable alternatives to the most destructive extraction practices. Can you talk about what some alternatives are in Sudan?
Our own knowledge is not in the extractive industry, it's in dams. And so we have promoted small-scale solutions in the water and the energy sector. I can't really give you a specific program for Sudan, but most of the African poor live in the countryside, far away from the electrical grid. And for them, small-scale technologies, renewable energy technologies, would actually be advantageous over large-scale projects, which mainly will power the cities and certainly not the countryside.